You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
Good afternoon. My name is Amber Balde. Let's get some slides up here. Oops, not yet. All right. My name is Amber Balde, and I would like to speak with you a little bit about the fate of the internet, how we got here, why it's so broken, and perhaps a little bit about what we can do to fix it. So first off, though, I would like to introduce you to something called Friend of a Friend, a wonderful new way to describe a social graph in a decentralized way. So we are able to create social networks without the need for a centralized database. Yay, decentralization. Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the World Wide Web, says, "I express my network in a Friend of a Friend file, and that is the start of a revolution." And indeed, revolution Web3 is, right? Wired is calling Web3 a fully distributed web-based system for publishing logical assertions. Not only can we make sure that data is available around the world, but we can make sure that it's closer to its point of origin and we're able to share it with some kind of veracity. Open data, the future of the web. Who's excited about Web3? Anybody? All right. I hope you're ready to buy my ICO, because actually Friend of a Friend came out in 2000, Tim Berners-Lee said that in 2007, and Wired said that in 2010. So if this was supposed to be Web3, what happened, and why aren't people aware of this? Right? Well, a lot of people are new to the space. If you became a developer in the last decade, you might never have heard about the semantic web. And if you started researching blockchain or getting involved in that in the last year or two, then it's probably completely new to you, along with things like dApps. And so over the last 12 months, that's what you see kind of on the side, over the last 12 months, all these terms are conflated. But a long time ago, there really was a time when we thought that Web3 was going to be a thing. But why wasn't it? Well, first of all, it was machine learning. That's a machine learning. Thank you. I'll be here all week. So having everyone mark up their web pages with a shared global ontology is hard. Most people just want to publish a blog. They don't really want to think about the data model of what they're putting forward. And it turned out that it's a lot easier to actually parse the content of what's on a website than it is to ask people to do that. Google got very good at it, and they knew that the map was not the territory. And so now we're even seeing this being applied to video. You can find what you're looking for, and Google can present it to you before you even knew that it's what you were looking for. Next, of course, were the business models. Again, those are business models. So thank you. That one was worse, I admit. So we ended up with an advertising-driven web because it was very difficult to monetize things like RSS and like the semantic web. So indeed, it is money that makes the world go round. And let's talk a little bit about what that means at the intersection of cryptography and finance. So financial cryptography is definitely a thing. A lot of people aren't even aware that it's a thing. But the tight coupling of cryptography to the financial industry has been around for at least 40 years, right? And normally, though, when people talk about this, they're talking about securing financial transactions with some kind of cryptographically assured system, something like running your banking system over SSL at a fundamental level, right? But they're not usually talking about taking something that's a cryptographic instrument and making it a digital representation of a financial instrument. So that is a little bit newer. But even that goes back all the way to the 80s. So there's a very long history of financial technology existing right at this nexus of cryptography and advances in software engineering, where we see really cool things happening and then get rolled back or get pulled back as they kind of confront the regulatory scheme. So for example, a lot of people aren't even aware that before 1975, when DES encryption was introduced and banks wanted to use it to secure their wire transactions overseas, all cryptography in the US was considered a munition that would only have military applications. So it was really the commercial impetus that got that conversation started in changing the entire regulatory scheme. So when we talk about things like Bitcoin moving into the banking system or that kind of uncomfortable edge case, sometimes there's actually good conversations that can come out of that. Moving forward, we had like David Chaum discovering blind signatures and moving forward to found DigiCash, but that came right after the Money Laundering Control Act that required people to disclose more about these transactions. At the same time, BlackRock launched what's called its Aladdin program, which is still extant today, one of the most major data aggregation programs in the world, and we'll kind of come back to that. And then that ran right into the beginning of the crypto wars. So when we started having conversations about strong encryption in Congress, as well as other countries around the world talking about what cryptographic suites they were going to support and whether or not we were going to have a splintering of internets where various protocols wouldn't even speak to each other. We've kind of arrived at that crypto balkanization in a way, in a de facto way, with the sorts of firewalls around the world, but at a fundamental level, we're still using a lot of the same networking protocols. All these conversations are happening again when we start talking about blockchain and distributed systems as they're being applied publicly these days. Moving forward, you had kind of what happened around the PayPal time, you had eGold, and then different projects we often don't consider to be digital money, like when Tencent in China announced its Qcoin, which was completely centralized, or Vodafone using M-Pesa using minutes as money, right? So moving forward, I think we're pretty aware of the history after that, but it's a much longer time frame than we think about. But fundamentally, strong encryption matters a lot. What is strong encryption? It's encryption that is not weakened by some sort of golden key. The entirety of the algorithm can be exposed and it is not weaker for doing so. So when we hear about after the San Bernardino shooting, the government or the FBI asking Apple to disclose or to be able to go into its systems and get information from the shooter's phone and unlock it, and they say, we can't, this is what they're talking about. And again, it's right back in front of legislators. So going all the way back to 1997, when the FBI director was making statements like saying that law enforcement is in unanimous agreement that the widespread use of robust non-key recovery, so strong encryption, ultimately will devastate our ability to fight crime and prevent terrorism. Now, in the intervening time, there has certainly been a number of incidents that have proven that, sure, it would have been nice if they did have this ability, but also there have been other skills that have been developed to work around this and to work in conjunction across both the commercial and private space so that we can actually deliver on some of the law enforcement requirements. So let's shift gears for a second and think about the entertainment industry. So another place where business models have mattered on the internet. No surprise, online delivery matters, and kids these days are going to get all of their media from the internet. I don't really think that that's going to change. Now, let's take a step back for a second to 1998. It was a good year. I mean, this was the year to be downloading media if you were gonna do it. I mean, look, we had Big Lebowski, you had Buffy, X-Files, like this was a good year. 98, okay. It was also the year that the DMCA was enacted. And the DMCA criminalized making, distributed, or using anything that circumvents DRM, digital rights management. And so that means that you're not allowed to deobfuscate any obfuscation that was keeping proprietary code secret, and you're not allowed to unwrap anything that is wrapped up cryptographically in the software that you have. It also apparently keeps boat hull designs private, because I have no idea. I guess there was some sort of lobbying incident there, but who knows. But every 3 years, we go back and we revisit this because they knew at the time that this was not going to be an extensible law. And so we've had to, over time, change it to, say, account for things like letting audiobook readers access the content of the books that they're reading, or to let security researchers be able to do their job without getting arrested at hacker conferences, or now letting you the right to repair, letting you repair your own car computer system, which you can do as long as it is not the entertainment system. And that's because of the ongoing lobbying efforts of this particular industry that feels existentially threatened. So thank the EFF. Every 3 years they're working on this. They're not the only ones, but they certainly do a lot of work to publicize the DMCA exemption process. So DRM is an intractable problem. It was an intractable problem for the industry because once a consumer has something, it is almost impossible to completely prevent them from being able to copy. I mean, it is impossible. You can always hire someone to sketch an oil painting of your favorite portrait. So once you've got it, you've got it. Screen rippers, et cetera. And there'll always be some level of privacy. But once streaming became a thing, as bandwidth was going up, the amount of piracy has actually decreased significantly as a percentage of internet traffic. And so begrudgingly, the industry has come on board here. But, you know, maybe we can throw a blockchain at it. I'm sure DRM was intractable before, but maybe now the blockchain will offer us hope. So, if you look at music industry revenues, yes, indeed, they have been down, but as streaming and premium streaming has been on the rise, the overall industry revenues are actually on the way back up. It's simply not the existing incumbents and distribution houses who are making that revenue. And so, yes, they are still pretty upset about it. But when you talk to young people, as a lot of you in the room are, you probably pay for music, right? A lot of people across every segment are beginning to have to pay for movies and music, and piracy is down. So now let's talk a little bit about the bubbling beneath the surface here. So data, what powers these things? This is the technology landscape of MarTech, marketing tech. So I used to have an analyst that worked for me when I worked at a bank, and I used to make them put all the logos on a PowerPoint slide. But I never made them do this many logos. Like, this is 5,000 different company logos that make up this industry. That's a lot. And so even within this single vertical, this vertical has verticals. And every single one of the companies within these various verticals is buying data, acquiring data, and selling data. Often the same data, often similar data, often enriched data. This is the flow of data when we talk about data brokers. And so, I mean, you read the terms of service, though, right? Every time you land on any kind of .com, this is NFL.com as an example, these are the various other services and websites that are hit simply with a public web request. This is what your browser has to load to render just their homepage. Let alone if you actually log into some app, and then that app requests to have your data and says, we promise not to reveal or sell any personally identifiable information. Well, as long as they strip your name out of that, then it's considered non-personally identifiable. However, and we'll get to this in a second, de-anonymization is relatively trivial. So we know what it means to be the product. We've been told for years that if you're not paying for something, then you are the product. But still, when we experience these applications, the landing page that you come to is not the same one that is their enterprise sales side. So for example, this is Foursquare, and they offer a custom audience segmentation. They can use all of your various check-ins to show kind of patterns of what people like you do, and can it become relatively identifiable once you start talking about, you know, a teacher that goes back and forth to the same location or the same school every day. So how anonymous is this stuff really? And how much do you care? Maybe you don't feel like you care because you feel like one application can have your data, but it's this entire ecosystem that ends up with it as the data diffuses through this marketplace and ecosystem. So de-anonymization is essentially inevitable. It's been demonstrated multiple times that the more amount or the larger number of various anonymized data sets that you have, along with the amount of time that you have to accumulate them, the easier it is to cross-reference things across many, many, many points. And beyond that, a lot of these companies will use unique identifiers that are not about your name, it's not your social security number, it's a kind of randomly fingerprinted identifier, but it's able to be reconstructed from other organizations as well, and then cross-referenced in a way that it's still traceable back to someone who is you, but simply does not have your name yet, but could, with a quick query. So even if you decide that you want to entirely opt out of this system, then you're still using a phone, right? And your phone, even a dumb phone, unless you are on a physical call, that information that goes to your telco company is considered information that they are allowed to sell, and they do. So sometimes they sell it to what are considered authorized consumers, like, for example, helping bounty hunters locate their defendants in real time. But sometimes those people also resell that data in a third-party market, and they're not necessarily supposed to do that, but they do. There was a Motherboard article a month or so ago about with any phone number and $300, you can track down any person within a couple meters, right? This is the company that was involved in that, and it's not like they're selling this on the dark web. This is their standard website, right? You simply need to know where to go. And if you look at this, even their stated business model is that they provide the current data that can help you prioritize and successfully track people down and collect. I mean, it is what it is. So as long as people kind of stay in their lane, if you're talking about BlackRock's Aladdin providing financial and risk analytics, and you're talking about the marketing industry helping you buy something, and maybe you're talking about a social media company just customizing your experience, maybe we're okay with that. But then you get companies like Palantir that actually cross all these verticals. They have a consumer side, there's defense applications, and there's not really an accountability or visibility into where all of this kind of data mixes together or which things are productized across which verticals. And we really just have no say in that. And so it was in 1958 that John von Neumann had said that the ever-accelerating progress of technology gives the appearance of approaching some essential singularity beyond which technological progress will become rapid and complicated, and beyond which human affairs, as we know them, could not continue. That sounds terrifying. So it's the complexity. It's the ever-rising complexity that simply means this internet kind of thing, this data science thing, this computing thing has kind of gotten away from us. But there is nothing inevitable about democracy. That's another thing. This is from the author of Sapiens, which you're probably familiar with. I preferred 21 Lessons for the 21st Century personally. But we're told that the kind of arc of history reaches towards progress. But we're starting to see now, as technology accelerates, that really there is nothing inevitable about democracy. And a lot of our current technological advancements are actually furthering authoritarian regimes. In fact, when Foreign Affairs asked a variety of academics and think tanks and consultants and government employees in various positions, you can see that it skews towards those people generally agreeing that this statement is true. Somewhat concerning. Did I forget about Facebook? No, I didn't forget about Facebook. Okay, let's talk about Facebook. All right, so we're all familiar with Cambridge Analytica, and we don't have to go over that again, but that was a business model working as intended. That was not a data breach. That was not malware. That was not leakage. That was not insider threat. That was a business model working as intended. And now we're okay though. So today we see, this is Mark Zuckerberg's quote. He's saying that already we're seeing that private messaging, ephemeral stories, and small groups are the fastest growing areas of online communication. And there are a lot of reasons for this, like the intimacy of communicating one-on-one, and being able to do things like payments privately and securely. It's nice they're kind of catching on to this, right? So our new privacy-focused platform will be built around several principles, like private interactions, encryption, permanence, safety, interoperability, and secure data storage. And so we've created a blockchain team as well. Exciting times at Facebook. And sure, we can trust that that's kind of what's going on, but it turns out that maybe Facebook hasn't always done a great job of telling us what they're working on. So going back to when users were surprised by the news feed back in 2006, to when their real name policies were making vulnerable populations scared and more vulnerable, but they said, you know, authentic identity is important to the Facebook experience. There was the time that they exposed a bunch of additional data along with your phone number to any friend who put your phone number in when you uploaded your contact list, and then they said, you know, that was inadvertent. Then there was the data science experiment where they were manipulating the moods of your feed to make you happier or angry with what they showed you, you know, and they said, I can understand why some people might have concerns about it. So the kind of ongoing incident after incident and then half apology and response and promise to do better we've seen before. But what seems to be a little bit different about this time around is that we do have this kind of privacy stuff happening in a way that maybe they are going to make some really credible changes to the world. So we'll see. This is from Alex Stamos, who's the former CISO at Facebook, and he had said on Twitter that, I think it's easy to underestimate how radical WhatsApp's decision was to deploy end-to-end encryption, right? So Facebook has WhatsApp and Instagram, and together, collectively, you know, Facebook is now legacy code. They've got to put all this stuff together, and perhaps the best way to do that is actually to use some of this technology that helps you cross trust boundaries and allows you to bring things together in new end-to-end encrypted ways. Now, are they going to do it? Is it an engineering feat that's even possible? I guess that remains to be seen. So why is it so hard? Well, I think we want to believe that freedom equals ethical equals good guys. And so we're all on the same side of this fight, right? But there's a problem. Sometimes really important stuff disappears from the web. like, say, all of the EPA data after an administration change. Then there's other problems, like sometimes really terrible stuff will not disappear from the web. I don't know, like, say, revenge porn, right? This is a case where there are actually good arguments on both sides, and all of these design choices are a series of trade-offs. Whenever you're making a platform, you're the person or you're the team that's deciding how these things work. So the trade-off between privacy and enforcement we've talked about, but similarly, anonymity and abuse, freedom and responsibility for content, data portability versus protection, user choice versus user protection, and human rights and local law. All of these are sliders that you can adjust, but they end up with kind of the ethos of your ecosystem. And I think we can all think of different examples of different networks or social media applications that have gone after different ways to align these sliders to very different results, right? So maybe when you don't like the incumbent, you decide to remake it, you're gonna make your own, you're gonna do it yourself. And as Cory Doctorow said, when I scrape your website to make my search engine, that's progress. But when you scrape my search engine, make your search engine, that's fraud. And this was a talk that he was giving at DWeb Summit last year. He was talking about how the problem with big data, or with big tech, isn't the tech, it's the big. And saying adversarial interoperability, so that ability to scrape and to interoperate regardless of what the originator wanted you to do in the first place. This was the hacker's unbeatable finishing move, but it doesn't stand a chance against the monopolist's counter move, the ability to turn your whims into legally enforceable rights. And so we see that the choices that some of these early startups made that made them get so big to where they are today, they've now made fraudulent or illegal or a violation of the CFAA for startups or hackers or other programmers to do. And so they're using this regulatory climate to cement their incumbency. But at the margin, of course, they're willing to make concessions, especially if those concessions are so expensive that they'll be the only ones able to comply with them, whereas new entrants are, again, pushed out of the market. So, sure, I mean, you have choice, right? Everybody has choice. Privacy is easy. Just use all of these different tools correctly all of the time. Not a problem. I mean, I don't know about you, but I know I use at least three of these things regularly, but I'm probably like a crazy person compared to most people. But there's probably something on here that at least that everybody uses every day that they don't even realize, and that's Let's Encrypt. So Let's Encrypt allows developers to very easily set up certificates for their website without having to go through kind of the cumbersome CA process the way that they used to. And because of that, the rise of HTTPS traffic is just astronomical over the last 5 years. And so it's a background win for privacy and security that hasn't required users to change their behavior at all. Indeed, there are a lot of new tools that change how we can weight those various trade-offs that we were talking about, like enforcement and privacy, right? So first off, I would like to offer a preemptive apology to all of the researchers whose life work and PhDs are about to be shown in a single PowerPoint slide. I feel for you. Okay, so there are real advances in peer-to-peer networking happening, and not just at the protocol level, but at the applications that sit on top of these networks as well. They're not clunky, they're not terrible to use, they can feel delightful, they're designed around human user stories. Two examples of these are Patchwork and Riot that are sitting on top of Scuttlebutt and Matrix, respectively. You can build your own applications on top of them, but they are trying to tackle that opening up of the social graph problem and doing it in ways that offer a lot more privacy guarantees. Very cool projects. Okay, zero knowledge proofs. I'm gonna get my water for this one. All right, so zero knowledge proofs are extremely complicated cryptography things, right? So maybe you sit down to read a paper and you didn't understand it, so you're gonna read another paper. This may or may not be the story of my life. Okay, you pretty much understood that, but maybe you want to read the formal definition just to make sure you understood it, because it kind of feels like moon math a little bit, and you're not really sure where all the things are lining up. It didn't quite work, so now you're going to read how to explain zero-knowledge protocols to your children, and then you're like, wait, is that a uterus? What is that down there? I'm not exactly sure what's happening. So now I'm going to read the blog, How to Actually Explain Zero-Knowledge Protocols to Your Child, which I really appreciate is on Medium, and you should definitely check out. So in the blog, no, they're caves, they're definitely caves. There's people in caves, and there's elliptic curves, and the people are talking about jelly beans. They're talking about how to keep jelly beans private, how to communicate what the color of a jelly bean is. I'm not really sure. So you spend 5 more hours trying to figure out what the jelly beans in the caves are, and now you're like, I don't know, cryptography is not for me. I don't really understand what the hell's happening here. It's about that time that one of your friends walks up and says, hey, I see you've been reading about zero-knowledge proofs. Can you explain that to me? I've always wanted to know, and I hear they're like the hottest thing in cryptography. And so you say very confidently, well, ZK-SNARKs allow verification of the correctness of computations without having to execute them or even to learn what was executed. All right, so that's what ZK-SNARKs are. And then you have that one kind of asshole friend who says, what about bulletproofs? And you're like, well, that's like SNARKs, but with more yelling on Twitter, and we don't really want to talk about it. So there's a lot of cryptography happening, right? And these things are all very subtly different, but there are meaningful advances in the efficiency of each of them, and they're kind of trading off between each other and arguing about which is best under which, in which circumstances and for which applications. Some of the best work in active production level ZK-SNARKs is in the Zcash currency. Full disclosure, I am on the board of the Zcash Foundation, which is the nonprofit, not the company. It really is brand new work, and they're figuring out how to make something like Bitcoin more fungible and truly private. So it's very important and awesome work. But I want to caveat that. I've been hearing a lot recently about how zero-knowledge proofs are like this silver bullet that's gonna solve absolutely everything for everybody. Just like throw some zero-knowledge on it and like call it a day. Like, this is the future of privacy. But just a couple days ago, researchers, Sarah Jamie Lewis at Open Privacy, feel free to send them a donation for this work, they found a critical backdoor, which was theoretically an unintentional vulnerability, that was in this Swiss online voting system. And it was within the shuffling and application of the zero knowledge proof at that layer. It was very, very subtle, and the system had been audited before, and people had not discovered this. So Matthew Green, who was also kind of working on that research with her, had said that even worse, what could come out of this was that a stolen election that appears to be verified by zero-knowledge attestations could be end-to-end verifiable. It would look like it worked, right? Thanks to the appearance of the valid ZK proofs, and good luck disputing math. So we kind of have this double-edged sword, where at the one hand, we can use things like formal verification, we can use things like these zero-knowledge systems to reduce the overall surface area where we think there might be problems, and some of the problems in the rest of your code maybe don't become as important. But the issues in that specific area are incredibly nuanced and subtle, and there are very, very few people on the planet who are qualified to audit them. So we need to be careful in how we're deploying these things. Okay. But back to awesome stuff, so that's less terrifying. Analysis-resistant networking. So everybody here, I'm sure, has heard of Tor. But that's not the only way to achieve anonymity or privacy in some of these networks. You might have heard of Freenet, significantly older, but what I want to talk about is some of the newer projects, like Katzenpost. So here we have a mixnet. It's a little bit higher latency, but some really cool projects that are working on implementing this. And then Dandelion, which was coming out of actual optimization of routing on top of Bitcoin transactions. So figuring out that they go through this kind of anonymity stem phase and then fluffing rather than just general broadcast of transactions actually improves the privacy properties of the network layer of security. Or the network layer of privacy. That's super cool. Like, this is research that just wouldn't have happened before people were really interested in sending crypto transactions around the world. So, you know, good for these projects. And I think, oh, I have one more here. So computation using secret data. Secure multi-party compute and homomorphic encryption, which are two different things, but allowing us to do something similar, which is to do computation in a more secret way, or a way that's more privacy preserving. So on the one hand, you can be bringing the compute to the data in SMPC, and on the other hand, we're actually doing the math on the data while it's still encrypted. Homomorphic encryption is much slower and less far along, but very, very promising in that you could do it in a very public way, but still not be able to actually see the inputs of what's going on. So these things, keep an eye out. These could change data science forever. The point I was about to make is that blockchain is awesome, blockchain hype is awesome. It has brought renewed interest and funding and the attention of fantastic researchers into the practical applications of these niche areas. So a lot of longtime academics are now advisors to really cool new companies, and their work is finding new practical applications. I think that's something that we should all be happy about. But it's not just blockchain. It's not just blockchain that's providing all of this, the changes in technology these days, right? There is a whole other world out there, people keep telling me. But the stack is changing regardless of whether or not everything in blockchain land just went away tomorrow, right? If you're not familiar with Wordley diagrams, I totally recommend Simon Wordley's talk about it. This, I think, GoTo 2018 was a really good one. But this is from that kind of showing the various layers of the stack, but saying that over time, things move from something that is a bespoke kind of towards something that is custom built, towards a product, towards something that becomes a commodity, right? So you're kind of, I guess from your side, it's going this way. But so we're moving from secret sauce through commoditization. And so we've seen this push happening in the shift from on-prem towards cloud, in the shift from the shift towards DevOps. But now we're starting to see that kind of, again, moving up, and now we're seeing the push in our runtime frameworks and operating systems toward this kind of serverless model. And it's certainly not at large enterprises yet, but it's coming, right? And regardless of what else is happening, this allows us to architect applications in new ways. Now, right now, serverless mostly just means somebody else's server. But it doesn't have to. It could be in a more peer-to-peer kind of a way that really can let you decentralize things that right now are simply not possible. And I'll add on to that a note about WebAssembly. So describing this kind of memory-safe, sandboxed execution format. So a way for us to run applications in the same way consistently across browsers, and not just web pages, but real applications, right? So heavyweight applications, things like game engines even, can run entirely in the browser. Kind of like what Java applets were supposed to be, but never really achieved. And this is being driven by Google, by Mozilla, right, by the big browser makers as a web standard, but it's not ubiquitous yet. But in the next few years, it certainly will be, and people that are building on things that will compile to WASM can build different types of applications with different guarantees, especially if you're looking at building, say, smart contracts, which do need to have this kind of deterministic execution. You can then not necessarily use Solidity in Ethereum environment. You can write in other languages that will compile there, and now we have a whole kind of web operating system, and that's pretty cool. So what does this new world look like? Well, I don't know. I don't want to call it Web3, so I call it the Weber Next. It's kind of like the Weber Nets, but like the Weber Next. I know, it's like fetch is not going to happen. I know, but I keep trying. I keep trying. So, okay. But what does this mean to me? This means what is it that we're actually looking for? Regardless of somebody's protocol, somebody's coin, somebody's, you know, vertically integrated stack that they're trying to sell you, what are the properties of a system that actually does the things that we're looking for? Well, data hopefully can be kept closer to its point of origin. Trust is minimized in the future. We're using least authority privileges for data and identity. Maybe you have low-level protocols that are more censorship-resistant than they are now, but higher-level applications that can protect user safety. You can have portability and interoperability seen as advantages, a return to that concept of adversarial interoperability. Maybe there's blockchains where they're helpful. Certainly, if you're sending some sort of value across the internet, it's a great choice. And the user experience needs to rival the current web. And so when we talk about things like WASM that can let you execute things faster, this is where we start saying that it's not just about throwing a blockchain at it, but it's all these kind of things coming together in a new way of looking at application architecture, where people start to want to use or build these applications, not because they said, I need a blockchain, or I like privacy, but because they said, this is more fun, this lets me create applications that actually solve my problem, and this is where my friends are going. And that's what we have to get to. So this is the way we kind of think of it at Clover, but it's just not to dig too deeply into this, but there's a lot of pieces that are optional, right? You should be able to map something like BitTorrent onto this as easily as you map an enterprise blockchain pilot, or as easily as you map a different kind of decentralized application. Blockchain optional. But there are various choices you need to make at different layers, and we need to be more cognizant when we throw this word like decentralization around what it really means. It's not this binary state. It's not about your network topology. It's about the accountability of the system that comes out of it, and about the choices that you've made at every level that either ensconce one existing kind of power bottleneck or allow some sort of choice or agency. So I spend a lot more time thinking about the kind of top up there, these points, but what do we need to make this real? Now we've talked about what it might look like and why we want it to look that way. But in order to get there, it's not just about having some technology that somebody suddenly invents and puts out a blog post, right? We need businesses to see decentralization as an opportunity. We need them to be able to, say, deliver the same kind of business insights that they're getting out of a huge data lake without having that huge data lake. We need a regulatory climate where crypto asset ownership and usage is feasible if you want to bake that into any kind of application you're working on. We need mobile connectivity for the half of the human population that's going to be coming online over the next decade and is never going to have a laptop or desktop computer. We need to make key management easier for regular humans. I mean, we can barely manage our passwords. Now we want regular people to manage private keys. Sounds complicated. And of course, all of the kind of the challenges that are going on in blockchain land around scaling and everything else. And then finally, you know, great developer tools. So that's what I'm working on. But yeah, awareness is growing. There's definitely a hearts and minds story around or in society today, right? Like the cypherpunk dream of making everyone want to learn about why their privacy is important has come true in that I think there is a lot more awareness, but people don't really know what to do with that awareness. And most of the time, that means that they'll spend about 30 seconds reading an article about how they're terrified. Maybe they'll post about it on Facebook, and then they'll go back to their actual, like, two jobs that they're doing to support their normal life. So the idea that we're going to win the hearts and minds of every human on the planet is probably a bit far-fetched. But sure, it's on the rise. Now, it's not on the rise enough compared to something like GDPR. So when you get a regulatory rule or something that forces people to look at this thing, then all of a sudden, yes, there's intense scrutiny. That's around the peak there is, of course, when you got all those emails saying, like, due to GDPR, our access rights have changed. But then it drops off again. Like, what happened to our collective consciousness? Well, people do indeed care about making money, so there's Bitcoin on top of it. Again, dwarfing GDPR down there at the bottom. That peak is now barely visible. This is a percentage of search results on Google, of course. But, you know, they don't care about it as much as they care about Fortnite. So what are we gonna do? Again, applications need to be fun for people to want to use them. And so we don't want something that's a zeitgeist. We need something that gets baked into everyday normal life because it's actually solving problems that real people have. And still, most people do not believe that privacy is a real problem that they have. So announcing Solid, yay. This really is from 2018. This isn't from 2010. I'm not messing with you this time. But this is Tim Berners-Lee's new project. And it says that Solid empowers users and organizations to separate their data from the applications that use it and lets people look at the same data but with different apps at the same time. So kind of the idea of bringing the app to the data, right? So there was a lot of fanfare when this came out, but you know, I was just looking at some of the code samples, and if you look at it, I don't know if you see right at that top line, it's like FOAF, where have I heard that before? Well, that's friend of a friend. Equals RDF, RDF is from friend of a friend era as well, right? Dot namespace, like everything old is new again. We're just trying to re-perpetuate the exact same things that didn't necessarily work the first time. So while the idea of pods and data sharing and the way that you know, authentication has been added to this, like the story is certainly growing. I don't mean to say anything negative about the project, but what we need to think about is that sometimes these ideas kind of become stuck in time, and we need to look at why it is that Web3 didn't work the first time. What did we talk? We talked about the machine learning thing. We talked about the business models thing. You know, so if we're creating something new, what is it that is going to be different than what happened last time? Or are we just gonna kind of keep shoving the same thing in the public's and developers' faces and saying, like, no, but you should really care this time? Similarly, And you know, John Perry Barlow, again, another kind of philosopher and idol of the movement, or the internet movement, and writer of the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, we all owe a great debt to what he has provided, but this quote is from Slate, saying that his distaste for regulation combined with an early sense that the internet would change the world and thus should be defended from the government by the people who would use it, likely helped lay the groundwork for the unhinged growth and corporate walled gardens that we have today, places where journalism has gotten lost in the weeds of fake news and new startups have diminishing chances of competing. So what if these pioneers of the web had given us a different vision, one that paired the insistence that we must defend cyberspace with a concern for justice and human rights and open creativity, not primarily personal liberty? What kind of internet would we have then had today? Right? So we're always fighting yesterday's war. He was concerned with government overreach coming out of Vietnam and out of the Cold War, and didn't foresee the corporate aggregation of power over the internet. So what are we doing as we're designing these systems today that is purely reactionary to the incumbent system, but completely missing who our overlords of tomorrow are going to be? We need creative thinkers, and we need to be able to break away from some of the dogma of the past. So, this is another fun timeline. It's like 50 years of cryptography and computer history here. I just cherry-picked like one thing a year of cool stuff that happened. But everything from kind of ARPANET goes live through when Microsoft was founded to when the RSA algorithm was published versus when RSA became a company. I didn't put when RSA started their conference on there, but it should probably be there. Like, there's a huge span of time between when some of the algorithms were created and it says I have 18 minutes up here. I don't know if this is music or what this is. Is that a plane? Okay. Great, it's the music of planes. I don't know, it's very loud. Okay, so there was a huge delta between when some of these algorithms were introduced and then when they were actually able to be implemented in ways that we find them more pervasive, especially within commercial software. And so we'll probably see that same thing today. The stuff that's being invented takes a long time to be productized. But what I want you to take away from this isn't like a huge list of stuff that happened, it's that it appears as though there is this time, or this arrow of time, this like linear nature where things are the way they are today because of the things that happened yesterday. But really, all of this is dependent on this kind of hindsight bias and survivorship bias that we have, where things could have been completely different. Going back to that idea of the arc of history and leading towards progress, we really don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And a lot of the working groups that you know we're in today deciding what the internet standards of tomorrow are going to look like, or even your enterprise blockchain standards, they feel a lot like the working groups of the 70s. I wasn't there, but I've recently read a fantastic write-up of Vince Cerf's work at the International Networking Working Group, which taught me that we have not named our working groups better in the intervening 40 years. But all about the fight between OSI and TCP/IP, right? And it's a fantastic story to learn. This idea of like the long memory that the people that were there the first time around can really inform us. We need to be having a lot more intergenerational conversations around how our technology ended up this way. And so, most of us in school are kind of taught this idea of the West and the rest, and like we have this feeling that there are the haves and there are the have-nots, and that in order for us to get richer, someone else has to get poorer, that there's this concept of global scarcity. But if you look at what the UN Open Data says, over the last 100 years, life has been getting better on average for almost everybody globally. Now, certainly there are enclaves where there is gender inequity or where terrorism is an issue or where other kind of horrible things are happening in authoritarian governments and everything. But on average, people have a better life expectancy and better income per capita than they did previously. So if you spend a lot of time in the weeds of something that's of a sector that's very concerned about the overlay of nation-state politics onto our cyber infrastructure, or where people are talking about crypto balkanization, or where we're very concerned about these kind of nation-state threats, it can feel like a military war all the time. Right? Or if we're even talking about the fights between these kind of protocols that are going on in the public blockchain space, it can feel like there really are camps and we really are at war for some kind of supremacy. But really, it's not such an issue of scarcity necessarily. And we probably, at some point, are going to need to come together and consider some of these more global issues, you know, like maybe when we all can't live on the planet anymore. And indeed, we are just getting started. When you're in that really deep rabbit hole of your particular industry or your area of domain expertise, it's because you love it, right? But you necessarily go deep and can't spend as much time going broad, and you miss out on all these amazing things that humans are coming up with all the time. So every year, there's many, many different cool things happening. But I mean, can you imagine 30 years ago what the idea, the prospect of HIV prevention and something like PrEP would be? Or that we're able to kind of have swarms of nanobots that function like bees now, or that we're committed, and NASA has been able to kind of demonstrate that they're able to send manned craft beyond Mars. Like, these are advancements for humanity, and it's important for us to recognize that we are all kind of in this together, and there is a reason for us as a collective to think about our technology choices, not simply in a sense of adversarial interoperability, but maybe it's about kind of collaborative interoperability at some point. We can hope, right? So we're only doomed to repeat history if we don't learn from it. Money, apathy, cryptography, those are the emojis I came up with. I don't know, live with it. Okay, so free markets, crypto economics are gonna solve everything. Or winning our hearts and minds of users and just educating them enough will solve everything. Or better technology, better cryptography, it's gonna solve everything. Every one of these has its flaws, right? Each of these is probably true in some sense, false in some sense, and meaningless in some sense. But the more that we fall back on them, or when you hear them, just be suspect and think about why it is that we're thinking that somehow technology is going to solve social problems, or that it is that our companies are no longer accountable to our social systems. And finally, there are a lot of people that care about the internet and about digital freedoms and the open internet. This is many of them, and I hope that you will support them with your dollars, your Bitcoin, your Zcash, your Monero, and otherwise. Thank you. I think I have a bit of, like, 10 minutes for questions, and there's a couple. I'm supposed to choose one of these questions. I forgot to tell you to submit questions via the app. I'm sorry. But there are questions. But I have to read them while you all look at me, and it's very uncomfortable. Well, this is probably the most helpful question. What can I, as a layperson, do to protect my data? And what are some of the basic tips and tricks, like using location services, social services, and social media? Okay. Sure, okay. So, things that you can do. I mean, password managers, probably the first. Tell everyone you know about using a password manager. Generally, something like 1Password or LastPass are pretty common. But I also I recently saw the Trezor hardware wallet is the first that I've seen that actually shows you the like not just the name, but the little icon of the site that you're logging into to verify that it is it's accurate. So. Adding two-factor authentication to everything, removing your phone number as account recovery from a whole bunch of services. This is a thing, in the last couple of years, they wanted you to add your phone number to authenticate everything again, which will help you recover your account, but it also means that if anyone compromises your main email account, that then they can use that access to reset pretty much all the rest of your accounts, and if they simjack you, then they can use the two-factor codes to the cloned phone. And pretend to be you. So, let's see. If you are concerned, if you actually hold any cryptocurrency, then you probably want to be very cognizant of simjacking, and you probably want to contact your phone carrier and have them add an additional password to your account. It doesn't matter. Mine was moved twice last year, even though I had that. It, like, social engineering, like, they just don't care, but you can try. You can also move to Google Fi, because there's no better customer service than no customer service. So it seems the only way not to get social engineered at T-Mobile is to use Google Fi. Other things, that was not a normal person answer, though. Other thing normal people should do, I would say Yeah, you can definitely run through all of your location services stuff and make sure it's turned off for applications that don't necessarily need it. If you're using an iPhone, the way that the granular permissions are presented is also very different than Android or something. So it's really going to depend which phone you have. Okay, let's see. I'm not answering the political questions. Okay. The fundamental business model of most SaaS companies is giving away the app and harvesting the data. What does it look like when they don't get to own the data? That is a very good question. So that's exactly the question that that end-to-end encryption quote from Alex Stamos was talking about, and Mark Zuckerberg's concern about what happens if, like, we can't actually harvest all of this data. So, I mean, the more nuanced answer, I guess, is how much have we pushed towards an area where we're not just using the data to make the customer experience better, where it's internalized and these applications feel some kind of accountability to us. And so maybe it's okay that they have some information about me, but they can't actually sell it onto this brokered data market. Versus what is it like if they're not using that data to drive a customer experience, but rather they're using it to, say, sell to a hedge fund. The alternative data market is, like, really big right now. And I ran out of time for slides. I actually had an entire slide of what it looks like to need to sell your data to a hedge fund, how you should organize it. But you can make anywhere from, like, $75K to $500K, you know, selling these kind of feeds a year to hedge funds. It really becomes a question of what it is that we allow or demand of our companies. Now, a lot of the technologies that I was talking about are the things that let you thread that needle. So you should be able to derive the same kind of business insights across data that is not necessarily in that single data lake if you are able to perform computations more broadly. But regardless, if your local data is on your local machine and the application is able to operate on it, then you can have a local experience, just like, I don't know if you've ever done this, but, like, you can install applications on your computer. They just run on the computer. And there's data in them, and then the applications work with the data that's on your computer. We had that whole model for a while, and, like, computers worked. So it is entirely possible that we are able to create a system where applications run locally, data can be local, but you can also disclose and share data, which can drive better customer insights in a way that is not quite so predatory. I guess we have time for one more. Everybody keeps asking about the antitrust thing. I put in the Cory Doctorow slide. You can extrapolate it for yourself. I didn't read this all the way, so this is dangerous, but let's figure it out. Would a system where any cloud service puts money in escrow when any user signs up so that if they violate their terms of service, the user can get paid? I assume that what we're asking there is, could we create some kind of insurance system? I mean, this goes back to the question of accountability. It's the third question that was on there, yeah. I have not heard of anyone proposing this. For probably obvious reasons, getting businesses to change the way that they do things is difficult. They especially don't tend to make these choices for altruistic reasons. I think a similar analog has maybe more data or more conversations behind it is the discussion of whether or not companies should be held accountable and need insurance for data breaches and cyber malfeasance. And that has gone back and forth. I mean, when you buy a car, if there's a recall on that car, or that car has some malfunctioning part that all of a sudden starts killing thousands of people, there's a large investigation and legal liability there. For some reason, those same kinds of laws have simply never applied to the software sector, and it has been an ongoing conversation as to whether or not they should, literally since the mid-90s. So things have not changed, but if that's something that you think should change, then that's a conversation politically where you can get involved in voicing that opinion because there are various kind of legislations that come up around requirements for cyber insurance and what payouts for that should look like. Okay, thank you.